Hello, my name is Steve Wiggins, and this is podcast number 6 of the Sex and Violence in the Ancient World blog. Today's topic is going to be Leviathan. As a child, I grew up in a rural town with no bookstores. The way that we managed to get books was to go with Mom on a Saturday morning to the Goodwill store, and while she was rummaging through the secondhand clothes, I would be rummaging through the book bin, where you could pick up just about anything for a quarter. One of the books that first captured my imagination was Rachel Carson's The Sea Around Us. I knew very little about who Rachel Carson was at the time. I simply knew that the idea itself was a captivating one. The picture on the cover of the waves crashing into the shore really captured my imagination. I had never been to the ocean, and it really felt strangely compelling to me. Even as a child, I started to read the book and tried to understand what Rachel Carson was saying, and got the general picture that her idea was that we as people had come from the oceans and were strangely drawn back to the oceans. Now, this didn't wash well with my upbringing, which taught me that people did not evolve and that we were specially created and all of that, but I did know that there was this incredible draw towards the ocean, and it's something that stayed with me my entire life. Powerful, provocative, the ocean was something that I took a special interest in even as I began my doctoral work. I started thinking about pursuing the issue of Dagon, as I had mentioned earlier in a previous podcast, since there was this association with the fish god, at least as a popular sort of idea that I would hope to play out, but instead moved in other directions. But at the same time, this concept of the ancient waters was one that wouldn't go away. One of the reasons for this is the absolute ambivalence of water in the ancient world. People knew that water was absolutely necessary for existence. You can't survive without it. Yet at the same time, it is dangerous and threatening. Floods were a very real part of life for much of the ancient world, and people had to deal with the overabundance of water at some times, while at others, drought or the absolute absence of the necessary water could also pose a very real threat to life itself. So what did the ancients believe about water? Well, they were smarter than we sometimes give them credit for being. Obviously, they had figured out the difference between salt water and fresh water. Salt water surrounded them in the form of the Mediterranean. Israel, of course, is right on the eastern coast of the Mediterranean, and Iraq, what was Mesopotamia in the ancient world, bordered on the Persian Gulf. They knew about salt water, and they knew that it was not fit for drinking or for irrigating crops. Clearly, there was also fresh water, the water that was necessary for human survival and for crop growth and for animals and whatnot. And so they came up with a scheme of trying to understand how this all fits into a larger picture. They understood water as being the primordial element. It was there from the beginning. Now, if you stop to think about it, it makes perfectly good sense with what your eyes see and how that explains the world itself. We see the ocean, or in the Mediterranean, being blue. In large quantities, water appears to be blue in the natural setting. And they understood what that was, and they looked up and they could see the sky was also blue. And this connection between the blue above and the blue below was a kind of ancient science, if you will. It stands to reason that there is a connection between the water they see in the ocean beds and those they saw above the sky. Something invisible must separate the water above from the water below, but they couldn't really figure out exactly what it was. Ancient people had different kinds of ideas about what this firmament or dome might have been that separated the waters above from the waters below. But when they stopped to ask the question, how did water get there? This is where the really interesting idea comes in. That is to say that water was already there. It was not a created element. Water existed. It was there in the very beginning. It was chaotic. It was dangerous. And even sometimes personified as a monster or a primordial dragon. But water did not require creation. Water was prevalent and and already part of the universe as they knew it. We don't really know where the idea of the dragon in the deeps comes from, but again, if you stop to think about it, it stands to reason, doesn't it, that the deep and mysterious and dark ocean, where nobody ever really goes, might not harbor some sort of creature that nobody had ever seen. And so it was perfectly reasonable to suppose that there might be some great monster living in the deeps. And so the name Leviathan is one that was eventually applied to this water creature. The earliest attestation of the word Leviathan, as we know it, comes from Ugaritic. Ugarit was a city on the northern coast of Syria, and so indeed close to the water itself. The word there occurs in the form Letanu, or something like that, meaning twisting one, coiling one, a serpent perhaps, was the idea that they had in mind. Some sort of monster from the waters, some sort of dragon in the waters. Why a dragon? We don't really know. Perhaps it was something that they actually had seen, some sort of sea creature that has a perfectly natural explanation but was outside of their realm of experience because it was in the water. Perhaps it was some sort of carcass that was washed up after a storm. We don't know what it was that led them to this idea, but even today, when unusual animal carcasses wash up on the shore because of various natural phenomenon and they're decomposed, people look at them and sometimes even still say, ah, this must be a sea monster. So the idea is a very early one and perhaps goes back to explain why people thought that there was a dragon in the deeps. So the people of ancient Ugarit knew about Leviathan. It seems to have been a monstrous creature, even in their mythology, perhaps a seven-headed dragon that had to be conquered or subdued by the gods. In the Hebrew Bible, the word Leviathan occurs in only five separate passages. It's a fairly rare word. In the passages where it does occur, we find Yahweh having to hold back the Leviathan in various places. And one of the poetic references speaks of Yahweh crushing the head, plural, the heads of Leviathan, again, clearly a play on the multi-headed dragon sort of idea. And even one more interesting passage notes that Yahweh created Leviathan to sport with it, or to play with it. So it's a plaything, if you will, in these kinds of ideas of Yahweh's preeminence among the gods. The Bible also has other words for the great deeps or for the water creatures. Tanin, dragon, as it's commonly translated, was another word, and this word occurs much more frequently than Leviathan itself. But the idea is that there is this creature in the waters, and Israel was not a seafaring nation. The coast of Israel along the Levant is flat and sandy. It has very few areas that could conceivably serve as harbors, and so there's no real place for a launching off point to explore the seas. The Israelites were not a seafaring people. And that adds the air of mystery and darkness to the water that makes it even more of a potential threat. People didn't know what was really there. And the unseen threat, as any good horror movie director knows, is far scarier than the one that you can actually see. So yes, the Israelites did believe in dragons, and they went to great lengths to explain them. The book of Job talks about Leviathan almost in terms like a crocodile, but much more scary than a regular crocodile. After all, it breathes fire, and it lives in the water, and no one has ever captured one. So it's that kind of mythological character or creature that Leviathan turns out to be in the biblical world. This represents in some ways the untamable aspect of water, and water as untamed also resembles people that also occur in a form of multitudes, vast numbers of people like the waves of an ocean, people who are not tameable, people who are not calmable, people who need to be subdued in some ways. So it's not unusual that early on Leviathan is taken as a kind of representation of the masses of the peoples, and maybe even as a form of government. It seems that even well before Hobbes wrote his book Leviathan, in which the Leviathan is a noun for the commonwealth, which abuses and takes advantage of the people who live in it, even before that, the ancients had come up with this idea of the sea dragon representing this mass of people that somehow needs to be contained, if you will. The idea of the sea dragon does not originate with Israel. As I said, the people of ancient Ugarit already had this concept of Leviathan. They also had other creatures in the sea, or at least other names for them. Probably the most famous is Yam, the god of the sea. The story is recounted in the Epic of Baal, where Baal, or Hadad, the great god who's in charge of the storm and who is the patron deity of the city of Ugarit itself, has to take on the sea in order to assert his kingship. And in doing so, he goes out to combat against Yam, who is given rulership by his father Ael. Yam is the king of the gods, if you will. Baal challenges him in single combat and defeats him, and just as the story starts to get interesting, the tablet breaks off. Unfortunately, this fate of tablets breaking off just when it's getting interesting is a fairly common one in the ancient world. But what it does tell us is that the people of ancient Ugarit also had this idea of God versus the sea. It's an idea that German scholars ran with in the 19th century and came up with the title Chaos Kampf, the struggle against chaos. And that's still a commonly used term to describe gods fighting dragons in the biblical world. So the idea was there before the ancient Israelites. We can go back even further, though, than ancient Ugarit. If we go back to their cultural predecessors in Mesopotamia, we find again the familiar story of the Enuma Elish, the creation story of the ancient Babylonians. In this story, we have the gods beginning again in a watery chaos. The ancient primordial deity Apsu, who probably represents the fresh water, and his mate Tiamat, who represents the unruly salt waters, together when they cohabit, they give birth to the gods. And so the gods are born of chaos. And when the gods become numerous and noisy, they take a radical kind of solution to this idea and decide to kill off the kids. It seems like a pretty harsh punishment, but there you go. And so as they are trying to decide how to handle the noisy generation of gods that have come from their union, Tiamat argues for a more compassionate approach, but Apsu simply says, no, let's just wipe them out. They're overheard by A, their son, also a form of Enki from the Sumerian times, who discovers their plan to wipe out him and his siblings, and so he takes the news to them, which frightens all the gods until they decide that they have to do something about it, but nobody's brave enough to take on the parents. They ultimately decide to kill Apsu, the god of the fresh water, and A takes over the role of the freshwater deity at that point. But Tiamat is now enraged because her spouse has been killed, and she decides to take on the task of wiping out the children, even though earlier she was compassionate. Now everybody's terrified. Tiamat, Mama, is mad. Who's going to do anything about that? Well, they don't know what to do, and the gods are all afraid. And so they finally come with the plan to ask one of the younger gods, Marduk, if he will take on the role of being the dragon slayer. Marduk is A's son, and he agrees for the price of taking over the leadership of the gods to take on the role of dragon slayer. And so the story ensues, and an edition of the Enuma Elish will give you the details of how that happens. The point that I'm making here is simply that we have the gods taking on the waters. If we go back even further, the Sumerians had a similar story of the deities taking on the dragon, the watery dragon, if you will. The Sumerian material is more broken and fragmentary, so it's harder to trace, but it's still there. What this means is this epic struggle against water, this epic struggle against the dragon, goes back to the earliest levels of human religion. It's something that starts us out at the very beginning. Now, an interesting development takes place from this point, and if we move forward instead of backward in time and come back to the Bible, we see that one of the references to Leviathan, namely the reference in Isaiah 27, which is an apocalyptic section of the book, talks about Yahweh's ultimate defeat of Leviathan, who at this point has become a kind of symbol for evil. And the idea develops from that point on, and into Christianity as well, that Leviathan somehow symbolizes the devil. This is an interesting development because Leviathan really is the representation of the waters, and will notice, for example, that by the time you get to the book of Revelation, there in the New Jerusalem, there is no sea. And I often puzzled about that as a child. Why is the sea gone? Well, the sea represents evil at this point in time, and so it has to be abolished, eradicated, and gotten rid of. And so the idea finds its way into modern popular culture as well. I wrote a post on the Hellraiser series a couple of days ago on my blog and mentioned some of the Cenobites there. As I looked into this mythology that developed around the Hellraiser characters, I was surprised to discover that their leader, the leader of these minion of Cenobites, is Leviathan. He's called the Lord of Hell. And the more that I looked into the concept of Leviathan in modern times, the more I discovered. I found that there are at least 5 novels, most of them in the horror science fiction genre, that bear the title Leviathan, as well as a motion picture that has that same title. And there were at least 4 death metal bands that bore the title Leviathan as their iconic emblem. And so the idea of this ancient deity, this water, this unruly water taking over and becoming a god, is one that has never really died out. But today, as we come to appreciate all that the ocean has to offer us, we realize that on our own planet, we know very little about this vast body of water that covers our own habitat. We know that about 3/4 of our planet is covered with water, and we know less about the deep sea than we do about the surface of the moon. And so we find ourselves living in this world where we're still dealing with the unknown when it comes to the deep sea. And so it's probably not surprising that when modern artists and writers are grasping for some concept that best embodies this unknown, the terrifying unseen presence on our own planet, the menace in our own backyard, that Leviathan still suggests itself as a viable candidate.